Welcome to the International Society for the Psychoanalytic Study of Organizations. At our 2008 annual meeting in Philadelphia, Elizabeth Henderson delivered a plenary address titled, Would You Die for Your Cause? Ms. Henderson will be introduced by Renata Groenwald-Bugay.
I try to link again to you, and I'm very happy to introduce Elizabeth. It's a very great pleasure. The last keynote speaker this last morning of this annual meeting of ISTO 2008, and the topic is Would You Die for Your Cause? Elizabeth has done a lot of consultancy work close to the edge of almost unbelievable challenges. In the important historical period of Europe, in 1989 and 90, when the Iron Curtain fell, she was asked to consult to the Minister of Privatization in Poland, and at that time, she was the only consultant to take part in the change process when Poles had to create a new economical situation. She has consulted to the city council in Belfast, at times with extreme violence in the society. Elizabeth is a director of the Recess College, which provides programs for senior executives. She also has introduced and is pioneering the use of a psychodynamic instrument, Leadership, Insight, and Personal Development. And she has run her own firm for the last 30 years. And now, Elizabeth, we look forward to sharing with you on this very thoughtful and challenging topic. Please.
Right, it is a pleasure to be here, as well as giving great trepidation, I have to say. My topic is, would you die for your cause? And in a sense, I'm only going to work at that tangentially. Clearly, what we are talking about is morality in relation to something that we think is bigger than ourselves. Would you die for your cause? For most people, the answer is probably no. What I do doesn't merit that kind of thing. But it is a commitment to something you regard as bigger. The question I am asking is, would you be prepared to live for your cause? And in order to do so, what would you give up? So I start this talk with about my own motivation, which has always been one for seeing the potential within organisations to be a holding ground or fulcrum for motivation and making meaning. The examples I discuss are about moral purpose in creating such a holding environment and how that links to the hurly-burly of organisational life, as well as a related but parallel theme of exploring the move away from victim to adulthood. And I do see the two as connected. The issue of morality interests me less as a question of right and wrong, ethical, philosophical, or political, and more as a psychological one. So my first example describes the underlying moral purpose of some young people in choosing to build up a social club as a holding environment, through which to develop their capacity for adult choice. Then that brings me to my second question of how and what the leader needs to do to fill the holding environment if that is designed to promote inclusivity. How is it to be occupied if it is to embody a spirit of life and the human struggle to negotiate between good and bad? So my second example is about a great leader, Gandhi. So, starting in terms of my own motivation, I found the conference title really provoking in terms of thinking about background, motivation, and career. And I thought I would just say that my own motivation starts with two influences that come from my biography. On the one side is my family background and culture, a heritage of a once wealthy family, part of the culture and daily life of a central European city. And though I was never part of it, the effects have always been with me, that suddenly their way of life was completely broken, stopped. And all that was important to the family no longer existed, and their personal survival was definitely in jeopardy. But on the other, given that my family was knocked to pieces, I found that it made sense to make a close study of the world by way of organisations. I found a potential for life and learning in the push and pull that goes on in and around organisations and in the way the organisation addresses its task. From a very early age, school, these two influences left me with a contradictory sense of how easily, on the one hand, organisation and order can break down and primitiveness come through, and, on the other, a curiously optimistic view of the potential for health of organisations to hold, develop and create purpose. So why is this important? Why is the holding environment important? I'm going to use a very modest situation to discuss it, because it's, in a sense, something you can get hold of. And it was a virtual organisation, a club, in the centre of downtown Manchester in the 60s, 70s. The people who came to the club were unemployed 20-year-olds with little engagement in society beyond a life on the streets. It was pretty rough. The nickname of one young man was GBH, which, if you're English, you'll know means grievous bodily harm. That was what he was called, and that's what he did. The presenting issues of violence, destruction and chaos led us to think how we could work with these people. And we arrived at the notion of working with the group through a governance mechanism. A group of us designed the club as an institution based on organisational governance. It was organised with a committee of 12, 3 adults and 9 local teenage representatives. The only rule was that all decisions had to be unanimous. We all learnt to negotiate, compromise, trade and broker decisions, represent factions, take authority over others, including peers, be unpopular for the sake of an outcome. We created an organisation that in itself could create opportunities. So it positioned itself as a club to negotiate with police, employers, and actually the magic of giving some of these people holidays. Seems to me that one of the things that is very basic that we all know but needs to be repeated is that organisations provide huge opportunities for growth. The club gave me a glimpse of the importance of giving people an opportunity to grow through relating to an organisation, and perhaps in contrast, how depriving it is if you do not have that. However, at the beginning, the members psychologically trashed the club and physically also. We had invested in it as a learning organisation with the central mechanism, the Joint Committee. However, the first 3 attempts we made to elect this governance committee resulted in the premises being shredded, the room completely destroyed. And GBH would look round the room, he would then leave, and then instantly, as if by magic, the site was reduced to splinters. I mean, there wasn't a single piece of furniture that was intact. We could see the result, yet actually, even when we were in the room, we couldn't see it happening. It was quite extraordinary. We were at the end of our endurance and felt that our offer was pure hubris. Who were we to know what they needed? The next time, in our view the last, we prepared for the election. To our amazement, out of the blue it seemed, young adult members voted onto the committee were absolutely solid, natural leaders, able to take authority for the next 2.5 years. How did it happen? How was it that, for instance, we stopped having Marilyn Monroe and Malcolm X regularly voted onto the committee in favour of real people? How come these solid, God-fearing, practicing Christian, immigrant West Indian, I'm using the language of the time, young adults were elected with the undoubted help of the older, vastly more streetwise delinquent gang, who then accepted their authority? Why did the change take place at this moment of time? Well, actually, I don't know, and I'd be very interested in... Let me just be clear about this. We can talk about the change in terms of containment, but that leaves unanswered the question of what created the tipping point to go in one direction rather than another. It could have been destroyed again. I've long wondered about the meaning of the action. Those who stood for election showed the others that they could make a moral choice by stepping forward. In my view, the morality was not ideological or ethical. It lay in the underlying assumptions. It was a moral cause with a difference. The morality lay in the decision of whether or not to take an active part in creating an environment within which dilemmas of health and destructiveness, right and wrong, could be played out in a living way and addressed. The people who submitted themselves for election had to draw on resources of moral integrity, personal courage, and, I think, an instinctive vision of the capacity of the club to hold development. And they did face the possibility of a gut-wrenching possibility of reprisal. It was not clear how they would be treated. So the choice of the club as a holding environment was a kind of moment of truth, a psychological moment of truth for the members, as well as a real one. A moral choice around participation through which ethical discrimination in terms of right and wrong can be developed. So it seemed to me to be seminal, yet wider and symbolic, life choice on their part, embedded in a very practical decision. Now, I think it is also, and I think these go hand in hand, I'm interested in what you will think about this, it seemed to me that on behalf of the whole group, they rejected victimhood. A victim mindset was probably a psychological reality for the more cynical and delinquent members. The less streetwise kids responded to the challenge of taking an adult position. So as not yet adults, they took an adult choice in order to confront the risks and ambiguities of becoming adult. And they chose the club as a holding environment. To me, it seems like a kind of circular, double loop, psychologically based morality for its members. The act of choosing to take ownership of the club was the one that began the process of development. And it's something about this circularity that I do find fascinating. May not be new, but it's always fascinating. The example leaves a number of questions swirling around in my head. If this kind of organisational experience is useful for the deprived, how would it support the development of those who are highly achieving? What does it offer successful people to engage in this? If achievement is a necessary part of leadership, do leaders, would leaders see that a holding environment is part of their leadership task? And what would be the effect on the calibre of organisational life if they did? And my third question, which I'm going to talk about in terms of my next story, is to what extent do the leaders of organisations or movements take responsibility for creating the holding environment that can stimulate the moral motivation of others? So, the holding environment creates the space to become what it is that you want to be or do what you want to achieve at the next level. So, what is this? In the last example, the young people chose to enter into a compact with the holding environment. So, what is the leadership task? How do leaders fill the space? Or put it another way, if you want inclusiveness rather than people taking sides, how does the leader fill the holding environment? How do leaders conceptualise and build it? What does the leadership of a holding environment ask of you in terms of mindset, commitment, psychological and emotional awareness, emotional acumen, and day-to-day practice? How adult do you have to be to do all that? That's a question I'd like to come back to. So I'm going to talk about how a leader creates or maybe fails to create the leading environment in the mind, and particularly when the organisation in question or the cause in question has a constituency of thousands operating across a vast multiplicity of different interest groups. So the story is about an extraordinary man on the world stage, Gandhi, who actually did not succeed in his ambitions, his objectives, yet, to my mind, achieved monumentally. The first question is whether we can learn from Gandhi. Is he too outsized a person for us to relate to and learn from? And my own feeling is that we have been struggling a bit with, can we look at examples of strength and discrimination, or do we need to look for the flaws? Because undoubtedly Gandhi had some fairly massive flaws, which you can all tell me about. There is no doubt about this. But one of the questions is, can we learn, and are we able to learn, from looking at the strengths? It's a question for me that I would like to play with. And the means with which they, such people, such leaders, address their task. So I'm going to look at Gandhi's power to develop a holding environment for his cause through 8 elements, capacities, I don't know what. First was his engagement in systems thinking of a moral inclusivity, always characterized by moral inclusivity. He included the enemy. Thirdly, his refusal of victimhood and of aggression. He never took shortcuts in putting the ends before the means. He was action orientated. Through a curious, quixotic, symbolic relationship of engagement, action, with detachment. His practice of self-transformation. 7, his ability to create the symbol that itself creates momentum. And lastly, the way in which he both lived and died. So I'm going to look at those and then see where we go from there. So how did Gandhi act? Now, it seems to me that Gandhi always spoke systemically, inclusively, with a perspective addressing the highest, the best aim of the system through a perspective of morality and spirituality. He lived with symbolic tension, heightening the dynamics for change rather than reducing tension, always subsuming himself to his cause, actively confronting tendencies towards any self-preoccupation or what he would have said, self-indulgence. As a leader, he includes the enemy in his moral circle. So I've got 2 quotes about his system thinking and his inclusion of others. He says, first quote, "Unlike those who engage in violent action," he says, "we do not try to exclude the adversary from the solution. On the contrary, we try to transform the opponent, drawing him in as a participant and beneficiary of the solution, not as an enemy to be overcome, but as a participant in the search for a truthful solution to conflict. So, needing the moral purpose of his enemies, he says, "We will not submit to this injustice." This is the British. "We will not submit to this injustice, not merely because it is destroying us, but because it is destroying you as well." And then he said something that can be read a little bit PC with hindsight from our stage, but I'll just say it in any case. "I can and do hate evil wherever it exists. I hate the system of ruthless exploitation of India by the British, even as much as I hate the hideous system of untouchability of India. I do not hate the domineering Englishman, even as I refuse also to hate the domineering Hindu." And this is where he goes further. "I seek to reform them in the loving ways that are open to me." Thirdly, he refused victimhood. And I think I can just say it simply, non-violence in the face of violence is the ultimate in terms of self-control and self-authorization. He also, fourthly, never took shortcuts in the process of liberation by putting the ends before the means. He saw non-violence as essential to the outcome. He was never seduced by the instrumental approach between ends and means. His cause always focused on the objective of removing colonial power, but he regarded non-violence as the only means for doing so. He saw the means not as a secondary element in the objective of change, but as the real enactment in the present of the desired future. He's action-oriented. The concept of moral meaning is not meaningful in itself outside of action. And I see that as quite a challenge to those of us who prioritize insight. There's something about the relationship between the two. He took steps into the hub, the center of the action, just as the kids in the social club did. But he combines engagement action with detachment. He says, "Detachment equals skillfulness in action. A person worried about the rewards and outcome of his work does not see his goal, only opposition and obstacles. He is thus equipped who is without desire for the result, and yet is wholly engrossed, wholly committed and involved in the task before him." So it seems to me that Gandhi's freedom lay in his independence from personal desire, and he saw detachment from personal need as the prerequisite for effective action. Gandhi appears to have lived as Bion, by the way, born in India, describes the analyst in the consulting room in ways we know well, but it's worth saying again, abandoning memory and desire for an inner attitude of mind, being wholly present in the moment as a form of action, rather than creating action by effort, ego, and will. In other words, the choice was never about him, it was always about the task and the work. So there was a hugely disinterested quality. Next one. How Gandhi worked on himself to achieve his ends. This is the question of self-transformation. How did such an ordinary little man, who in his 20s was called the briefless barrister, the barrister who never ever got any work for at least 2 years, never got any work, how did he manage to transform himself, stand and fight alone against the greatest empires of the time and win without firing a shot? The way he worked was by putting his own house, his identity, in order. For him, the starting place of leadership was himself. He began by a discipline of introspection. And again, I quote, And it must remind us of some of our own experiences of analysis, therapy, whatever. He says, through this discipline, meditation, one enters the deepest levels of consciousness where the storms of deep-seated conflicts rage continuously night and day. It is at these awesome depths, he says of himself, that love wrestles with anger and fear and ultimately gains mastery over all other things, all other feelings. And for me, that was one part of the work that we heard a little bit about in the speaker from yesterday morning, the work that allows you to open up to new ways of including others. For him, identity was not a given. He appears to have seen it as the raw material of transformation on which he could work as part of a creative act of self-renewal. He regarded life as an experiment in expanding the human being's capacity to love. And meditation he used as a dynamic discipline to liberate the spirit through denying parts of the self. There's a great deal in Gandhi about self-renunciation, making oneself a void. And I think, again, that may have been what Jack DeJoyo called yesterday, letting go of the pretentiousness of the idealized self-ego. And something he said about being simple, allowing you to get on with achieving what work needs to be done. And self-denial is not language we use. Nevertheless, I think it does describe the moment of change in which the old is emptied out so that new simplicity and clarity of purpose can find space. This did show, his attitude did show, and there is a quite amusing story of some London reporters cornering his aide, Desai. How is it, they demanded, this is, I don't know where it's a quote from, but it is a quote. How is it, they demanded, that Gandhi is able to talk so well for so long without any prompts? Desai said, what Gandhi thinks, what he feels, what he says, and what he does are all the same. He does not need notes. Then he added, smiling, and I challenged here. You and I, we think one thing, feel another, say a third, and do a fourth. So we need notes. And files. To keep track. Yeah, okay. There's quite a lot more, and I may have to leave my conclusions and let you do them. I'm very interested in the March to the Sea. There's a point in which the violence was increasing. Congress, the newly created Congress, wanted to struggle for complete independence and defy the British. The British authorities waited anxiously, afraid to arrest Gandhi and afraid to leave him free. Gandhi did not react to the pressure to act and continued to wait. He asked himself how to take on the British Empire in this huge freedom confrontation. Now, normally force would meet force. And I just love this story that Gandhi shifted levels, meeting the conflict not at the level it was posed in terms of power, law and order, and abuse, but at the level of vulnerability and absurdity. The answer came to Gandhi in a dream. It was breathtakingly simple. The government, the British government, taxed salt in a hot climate where it's a staple of life. The perfect symbolic action came to Gandhi. He invited some 20 people and held the space, I would say, for them to march to the sea where salt lay at the ocean edge free for the taking, which they did. The few swelled into thousands. The march threatened the government, Many marchers were beaten, put in prison, though very few killed. The action created a chink in the formidable mentality of empire for people on both sides of the conflict. It symbolized how powerless the powerful can be in the face of the weak, who are held together in some form of holding, and the ultimate absurdity of this exercise of legal tyranny. Moral actions are both real and symbolic. They do something that is concrete, but also signal the meaning of the moral action. They are both the territory and the map. Now, in the end, Gandhi did not prevent the violence and was killed seeking their reconciliation, and a Hindu extremist shot him. Did he die for his cause? My sense is he did not so much die for his cause, neither did he require comrades or enemies to die. Rather, he did require them to live. One might say he renounced parts of his life so he could live fully and die fully. Perhaps making the differentiation between the two less than we usually do. Accepting the risk to his own life, because the choice of living non-defensively carries the possibility of less defences against danger. So the question is, how was he able to invite so many for so long to practice reconciliation rather than revenge? Gandhi's approach was systemic, as I've said. He filled the holding space with an ethic of inclusivity. And I just wanted to say that, again, although I know this is something that has been described many times, I am very interested at looking at not the contradiction between a systemic approach and a psychoanalytic one, but by the capacity that is developed through the processes that we describe in psychoanalysis to be able to hold a systemic approach. And I've quoted, and I just like to put side by side with Gandhi's capability, what an English analyst, Ron Britton, who many of you know, says of how the primal triangle, we're talking archetypes here, provides a child with a link separately with each parent and confronts him with a link that excludes them. So I'm sort of building up to the description, which I so like. If the child can tolerate this tension, it provides him with a prototype for new relationships. And this is it. A third position then comes into existence from which object relations can be observed. The position provides us with the capacity for seeing ourselves in interaction with others and for entertaining another point of view from our own, whilst retaining our own, and for reflecting upon ourselves whilst being ourselves. What I'm trying to pull out of what Ron is saying there is that capacity that Gandhi, it seems to me, exemplified, which was the capacity to stay out of the system, to observe the interdependence of relationships, not needing to interfere, yet being able to intervene for the health of the system when he saw it needed that intervention. Now, I would say that to do this, he had to be free. And here I go a little poetic, so bear with me, please. Perhaps this is what it means to be finally adult. Freedom from the patterns of engagement, the defensive structures and stress. Freedom that allows you to be secure enough to trust in others, even when they let you down. To see their needs as distinct from your own. Perhaps this is what Gandhi was able to do in his leadership, through his symbolic leadership, that he was able to hold the moral integrity between the warring parts of a nation for so long. Perhaps adulthood is both so rare, yet in another sense so normal, that when we meet it, it feels like coming home, and we want to be near it in a world torn apart. There was a third story, which actually links the other two, so I'm sorry about this. And there is no time to tell it, but it is of a man of more ordinary stature, although quite successful in his own terms, a neurosurgeon. And the story describes how, because he had not been able to do the internal work, he got caught up in a perverse holding. And one of the questions I have about our society is how much people have an unsatisfied longing for a holding environment and then get trapped by an organisation that is not a truly worthy incarnation of the values that they put on it. In this story, James's desire for a holding environment, so I'm just giving you perhaps my conclusions on this, his desire was so intense that he got attached in a perverse fashion to the wrong organisation and could not examine whether the organisation embodied his values in a worthy fashion. Now, the difference with Gandhi was that his attachment to his ideal was intense, yet did not need confirming. He did his best to help an ideal become actualized in the world. Yet, if that ideal was imperfectly actualized, that did not shake his spirit. An imperfect vehicle could not shake his adherence to a value, and he could quite likely go through the pain as he did when partition happened, which was the thing he most wanted not to happen. Partition of India and Pakistan. But he could say, this is the best we can do. If it does not work, then we should let it go. And of all the people on the Congress side, he was the only one who, having opposed partition all the way, he then said, it is not fair if we do not give them all that we owe them. He was the only one. Everyone else was scared that Pakistan would then fight India. So they wanted to give as little resource as possible. In this story, so in contrast to the story of James that you don't know about, Gandhi's trust in his values was so firmly grounded in himself that even in the midst of conflict and reverse, he is fully alive and he is adaptable, which I think is a very important thing to look at in terms of how people can lead something and then get stuck with it when the situation changes. He could continue to offer a holding environment for others. He gave symbolic space and mental models that others needed in order to explore and act in their entire environment, Well, I would like, but I've got to do the conclusion quickly, to talk about the way in which these stories come together. The moral courage of the kids in the club. And I think that that, as I said, was a psychological choice, a moral choice. We've seen the way that Gandhi fills the space with content based on moral inclusivity connected to his personal being and yet, in a sense, held out there as an ego ideal, as somebody picked up in one of the earlier speakers this week. I've touched on the seductive power of a perverse holding environment with James. My question is, what does it take to create a holding environment? What are the conditions for doing so? There has been much study of the tendency in groups towards psychotic and splitting processes. And an environment that contains that can be used to many different aims. I'd just like to say fairly clearly, in terms of my first question, would you die for your cause? The extremist or terrorist fantasy appears to include a belief that good can be separated from bad and that bad can be eradicated, particularly in being overcome externally. in that case, both sides of a conflict act as a mirror image of the other. And I think this is where people then justify dying for their cause, because they're killing the bad externally, dying in order to kill. And the holding environment designed for that kind of project differs radically from one that is designed to be inclusive. So, would you die for your cause? Well, I think the answer is going to be no, unless you're absolutely pushed up against a wall. And I'd like to address this less as life and death issues and more in terms of the work of self-transformation. How much would you live for your cause? And I'd like to give Gandhi the last word. He says, "The art of dying is a corollary of the art of living." Thank you.
You have been listening to a presentation by Elizabeth Henderson. Her plenary address to the 2008 annual meeting of the International Society for the Psychoanalytic Study of Organization was titled, "Would You Die for Your Cause?" We express our deep appreciation to Ms. Henderson for her time and thoughtful presentation today. This has been a production of the International Society for the Psychoanalytic Study of Organizations. Copyright 2008. Duplication or distribution of this recording is prohibited without the express consent of the ISPSO. Thank you.